Today we will be reading The American Pageant, Chapter 39, The Stalemated 70s. As the 1960s lurched to a close, the fantastic quarter-century economic boom of the post-World War II era also showed signs of petering out. By increasing their productivity, American workers had doubled their average standard of living in the 25 years since the end of World War II. Now, faithfully, productivity gains slowed to the vanishing point. The entire decade of the 1970s did not witness a productivity advance equivalent to even 1 year's progress in the preceding two decades. At the new rate, it would take 500 more years to bring about another doubling of the average worker's standard of living. The median income of the average American family stagnated in the two decades after 1970 and failed to decline only because of the addition of working wives' wages to the family income. The rising baby boom generation now faced the depressing prospect of a living standard that would be lower than that of their parents. As the post-war wave of robust economic growth crested by the early 1970s, at home and abroad, the can-do American spirit gave way to an unaccustomed sense of limits. Sources of stagnation. What caused the sudden slump in productivity? Some observers cited the increasing presence in the workforce of women and teenagers who typically had fewer skills than adult male workers and were less likely to take the full-time, long-term jobs where skills might be developed. Other commentators blamed declining investment in new machinery, the heavy costs of compliance with government-imposed safety and health regulations, and the general shift of the American economy from manufacturing to services, where productivity gains were allegedly more difficult to achieve and measure. Yet in the last analysis, much mystery attends the productivity slowdown, and economists have wrestled inconclusively with the puzzle. The Vietnam War also precipitated painful economic distortions. The disastrous conflict in Southeast Asia drained tax dollars from needed improvements in education, deflected scientific skill and manufacturing capacity from the civilian sector, and touched off a sickening spiral of inflation. Sharply rising oil prices in the 1970s also fed inflation, but its deepest roots lay in government policies of the 1960s. Especially Lyndon Johnson's insistence on simultaneously fighting the war in Vietnam and funding the Great Society programs at home, all without a tax increase to finance the added expenditures. Both military spending and welfare spending are inherently inflationary in the absence of offsetting tax collections, because they put dollars in people's hands without adding to the supply of goods that those dollars can buy. When too many dollars chase too few goods, prices rise, as they did astonishingly in the 1970s. The cost of living more than tripled in the dozen years following Richard Nixon's inauguration, in the longest and steepest inflationary cycle in American history. Other weaknesses in the nation's economy were also laid bare by the abrupt reversal of America's financial fortunes in the 1970s. The competitive advantage of many major American businesses had been so enormous after World War II that they had small incentive to modernize plans and seek more efficient methods of production. The defeated German and Japanese people had meanwhile clawed their way out of the ruins of war and built wholly new factories with the most up-to-date technology and management techniques. By the 1970s, their efforts paid handsome rewards as they came to dominate industries like steel, automobiles, and consumer electronics, fields in which the United States had once been unchallengeable. The poor economic performance of the 1970s hung over the decade like a pall. It frustrated both policymakers and citizens who keenly remembered the growth and optimism of the quarter century since World War II. The overachieving post-war generation had never met a problem it could not solve. But now, a stalemated, unpopular war and a stagnant, unresponsive economy heralded the end of the self-confident post-war era. With it ended the liberal dream, vivid since New Deal days, that an affluent society could spend its way to social justice. Nixon Vietnamizes the war. Inaugurated on January 20, 1969, Richard Nixon urged the American people, torn with dissension over Vietnam and race relations, to stop shouting at one another. Yet the new president seemed an unlikely conciliator of the clashing forces that appeared to be ripping apart American society. Solitary and suspicious by nature, Nixon could be brittle and testy in the face of opposition. He also harbored bitter resentments against the liberal establishment that had cast him into the political darkness for much of the preceding decade. Yet Nixon brought one hugely valuable asset with him to the White House: his broad knowledge and thoughtful expertise in foreign affairs. With calculating shrewdness, he applied himself to putting America's foreign policy house in order. The first burning need was to quiet the public uproar over Vietnam. President Nixon's announced policy, called Vietnamization, was to withdraw the 540,000 U.S. troops in South Vietnam over an extended period of time. South Vietnamese, with American money, weapons, training, and advice, could then gradually take over the burden of fighting their own war. The so-called Nixon Doctrine thus evolved. It proclaimed that the United States would honor its existing defense commitments, but that in the future, Asians and others would have to fight their own wars without the support of large bodies of American ground troops. Nixon sought not to end the war, but to win it by other means, without the further spilling of American blood. But even this much involvement was distasteful to the American doves, many of whom demanded a withdrawal that was prompt, complete, unconditional, and irreversible. Anti-war protesters staged a massive national Vietnam moratorium in October 1969, as nearly 100,000 people jammed Boston Common and some 50,000 filed by the White House carrying lighted candles. Undaunted, Nixon launched a counteroffensive by appealing to the silent majority, who presumably supported the war. Though ostensibly conciliatory, Nixon's appeal was in fact deeply divisive. His intentions soon became clear when he unleashed tough-talking Vice President Agnew to attack the nattering nabobs of negativism, who demanded quick withdrawal from Vietnam. Nixon himself, in 1970, sneered at the student anti-war demonstrators as bums. By January 1970, the Vietnam conflict had become the longest in American history, and with 40,000 killed and over 250,000 wounded, the third most costly foreign war in the nation's experience. It had also become grotesquely unpopular, even among troops in the field. Because draft policies largely exempted college students and men with critical civilian skills, the armed forces in Vietnam were largely composed of the least privileged young Americans. Especially in the war's early stages, African Americans were disproportionately represented in the army and accounted for a disproportionately high share of combat fatalities. Black and white soldiers alike fought not only against Vietnamese enemy, but also against the coiled fear of floundering through booby-trapped swamps and steaming jungles, often unable to distinguish friend from foe among the Vietnamese peasants. Drug abuse, mutiny, and sabotage dulled the army's fighting edge. Morale appeared to have plummeted to rock bottom when rumors filtered out of Vietnam that soldiers were fragging their own officers, murdering them with fragmentation grenades. Domestic disgust with the war was further deepened in 1970 by revelations that in 1968, American troops had massacred innocent women and children in the village of My Lai. Increasingly desperate for a quick end to the demoralizing conflict, Nixon widened the war in 1970 by ordering an attack on Vietnam's neighbor, Cambodia. Cambodianizing the Vietnam War. For several years, the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong had been using Cambodia, bordering South Vietnam on the west, as a springboard for troops, weapons, and supplies. Suddenly, on April 29, 1970, without consulting Congress, Nixon ordered American forces to join with the South Vietnamese in cleaning out the enemy sanctuaries in officially neutral Cambodia. Angry students nationwide responded to the Cambodian invasion with rock-throwing, window-smashing, and arson. At Kent State University in Ohio, jumpy members of the National Guard fired into a noisy crowd, killing four and wounding many more. At historically black Jackson State College in Mississippi, the Highway Patrol discharged volleys at a student dormitory, killing two students. The nation fell prey to turmoil as rioters and arsonists convulsed the land. Nixon withdrew American troops from Cambodia on June 29, 1970, after only 2 months. But in America, the Cambodian invasion deepened the bitterness between hawks and doves, as right-wing groups physically assaulted leftists. Disillusionment with Whitey's war increased ominously among African Americans in the armed forces. The Senate, though not the House, overwhelmingly repealed the Gulf of Tonkin blank check that Congress had given Johnson in 1964 and sought ways to restrain Nixon. The youth of America, still aroused, were only slightly mollified when the government reduced draft calls and shortened the period of draftability on a lottery basis from 8 years to 1 year. They were similarly pleased, though not pacified, when the 26th Amendment in 1971 lowered the voting age to 18. New combustibles fueled the fires of anti-war discontent in 1971, when a former Pentagon official leaked to the New York Times the Pentagon Papers, a top-secret Pentagon study that documented the blunders and deceptions of the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, especially provoking of the 1964 North Vietnamese attack in the Gulf of Tonkin. Nixon's détente with Beijing and Moscow. As the anti-war firestorm flared ever higher, Nixon concluded that the road out of Vietnam ran through Beijing and Moscow. The two great communist powers, the Soviet Union and China, were clashing bitterly over their rival interpretations of Marxism. In 1969, they even fought several bloody skirmishes along the inner border that separated them in Asia. Nixon astutely perceived that the Chinese-Soviet tension afforded the United States an opportunity to play off one antagonist against the other and to enlist the aid of both in pressuring North Vietnam into peace. Nixon's thinking was reinforced by his National Security Advisor, Dr. Henry A. Kissinger. Bespectacled and German-accented, Kissinger had reached America as a youth when his parents fled Hitler's anti-Jewish persecutions. In 1969, the former Harvard professor had begun meeting secretly on Nixon's behalf with North Vietnamese officials in Paris to negotiate an end to the war in Vietnam. He was meanwhile preparing the president's path to Beijing and Moscow. Nixon, heretofore an uncompromising anti-communist, announced to a startled nation in July 1971 that he had accepted an invitation to visit Communist China the following year. He made his historic journey in February 1972, enjoying glass-clinking toasts and walks on the fabled Great Wall of China. He capped his visit with the Shanghai Communique, in which the two nations agreed to normalize their relationship. An important part of the accord was America's acceptance of a one-China policy, implying a lessened American commitment to the independence of Taiwan. Nixon next traveled to Moscow in May 1972 to play his China card in a game of high-stakes diplomacy in the Kremlin. The Soviets, hungry for American foodstuffs and alarmed over the possibility of intensified rivalry with an American-backed China, were ready to deal. Nixon's visits ushered in an era of détente, or relaxed tension, with the two communist powers, and produced several significant agreements in 1972, including a three-year arrangement in which the food-rich United States agreed to sell the Soviets at least $750 million worth of wheat, corn, and other cereals. More important, the United States and the USSR agreed to an anti-ballistic missile, ABM, treaty, which limited each nation to two clusters of defensive missiles and to a series of arms reduction negotiations known as SALT, Strategic Arms Limitation Talks, aimed at freezing the numbers of long-range nuclear missiles for 5 years. The ABM and SALT accords constituted long-overdue first steps towards slowing the arms race. Yet even though the ABM treaty forbade elaborate defensive systems, the United States forged ahead with the development of MIRVs, multiple independently targeted re-entry vehicles, designed to overcome any defense by saturating it with large numbers of warheads, several to a rocket. Predictably, the Soviets proceeded to MIRV their own missiles, and the arm race ratcheted up to a still more perilous plateau, with over 16,000 nuclear warheads deployed by both sides by the end of 1980s. Nixon's detente diplomacy did, to some extent, de-ice the Cold War. Yet Nixon remained staunchly anti-communist when the occasion seemed to demand it. He strongly opposed the election of the outspoken Marxist Salvador Allende to the president of Chile in 1970. His administration slapped an embargo on the Allende regime, and the Central Intelligence Agency worked covertly to undermine the legitimately elected leftist president. When Allende died during a Chilean army attack on his headquarters in 1973, many observers smelled a Yankee rat, an impression that deepened when Washington warmly embraced Allende's successor, military dictator General Augusto Pinochet. Even so, by checkmating and co-opting the two great communist powers, the president had cleverly set the stage for America's exit from Vietnam, although the concluding act in that wrenching tragedy remained to be played. A new team on the Supreme Bench. Nixon had lashed out during the campaign at the permissiveness and judicial activism of the Supreme Court presided over by Chief Justice Earl Warren. Following his appointment in 1953, the jovial Warren had led the court into a series of decisions that drastically affected sexual freedom, the rights of criminals, the practice of religion, civil rights, and the structure of political representation. The decisions of the Warren Court reflected its deep concern for the individual, no matter how lowly. In Griswold v. Connecticut in 1965, the court struck down a state law that prohibited the use of contraceptives, even among married couples. The court proclaimed, critics had invented, a right of privacy that soon provided the basis for decisions protecting women's abortion rights. In 1963, the court held in Gideon v. Wainwright that all defendants in serious criminal cases were entitled to legal counsel, even if they were too poor to afford it. More controversial were the rulings in two cases, Escobedo in 1964 and Miranda, 1966, that ensured the right of the accused to remain silent and to enjoy other protections when accused of a crime. Those decisions erected safeguards against confessions extorted under the rubber hose and other torture. In the case of New York Times v. Sullivan, 1964, the court ruled unanimously that public figures could sue for libel only if they could prove that malice had motivated their defamers, opening a wide door for freewheeling criticism of the public actions as well as the private lives of politicians and other officials. In two stunning decisions, Engel v. Vitale in 1962 and the School District of Abington Township v. Shemp, 1963, the court outraged religious conservatives when it invoked the First Amendment, which requires the separation of church and state, to prohibit required prayers and Bible reading in public schools. The Warren Court also struck at the overrepresentation of cow pasture agricultural districts in state legislatures. Adopting the principle of one man, one vote, the court in Reynolds v. Sims, 1964, ruled that state legislatures, both upper and lower houses, would have to be reapportioned according to the human population, irrespective of cows. State writers and assorted right-wingers raised anew the battle cry, "Impeach Earl Warren." From 1954 on, the court came under relentless criticism, the bitterest since New Deal days. But for better or worse, the black-robed justices were grappling with stubborn social problems spawned by mid-century tensions, even, or especially, if duly elected legislatures failed to do so. Fulfilling campaign promises, President Nixon undertook to change the court's philosophical complexion. Taking advantage of several vacancies, he sought appointees who would strictly interpret the Constitution, cease meddling in social and political questions, and not coddle radicals or criminals. The Senate in 1969 speedily confirmed his nomination of white-maned Warren E. Burger of Minnesota to succeed the retiring Earl Warren as Chief Justice. Before the end of 1971, the court counted four conservative Nixon appointments out of nine members. Yet Nixon was to learn the ironic lesson that many presidents have learned about their Supreme Court appointees. Once seated on the high bench, The justices are fully free to think and decide according to their own beliefs, not according to the president's expectations. The Burger Court that Nixon shaped proved reluctant to dismantle the liberal rulings of the Warren Court. It even produced the most controversial judicial opinion of modern times, the momentous Roe v. Wade decision in 1973, which legalized abortion. Nixon on the home front. Surprisingly, Nixon presided over significant expansion of the welfare programs that conservative Republicans routinely denounced. He approved increased appropriations for entitlements like food stamps, Medicaid, and aid to families with dependent children, while adding a generous new program, Supplemental Security Income, to assist the indigent, aged, blind, and disabled. He signed legislation in 1972 guaranteeing automatic Social Security cost of living increases to protect the elderly against the ravages of inflation when prices rose more than 3% in any year. Ironically, this indexing actually helped to fuel the inflationary fires that raged out of control later in the decade. Amid much controversy, Nixon in 1969 implemented his so-called Philadelphia Plan, requiring construction trade unions to establish goals and timetables for the hiring of black apprentices. Nixon may have been motivated in part by a desire to weaken the forces of liberalism by driving a wedge between blacks and trade unions. But whatever his reasoning, the president's new policy had far-reaching implications. Soon extended to all federal contracts, the Philadelphia Plan, in effect, required thousands of employers to meet hiring quotas or to establish set-asides for minority contractors. Nixon's Philadelphia Plan drastically altered the meaning of affirmative action. Lyndon Johnson had intended affirmative action to protect individuals against discrimination. Nixon now transformed and escalated affirmative action into a program that conferred privileges on certain groups. The Supreme Court went along with Nixon's approach. In Griggs v. Duke Power Company, 1971, the black-robed justices prohibited intelligence tests or other devices that had the effect of excluding minorities or women from certain jobs. The court's ruling strongly suggested to employers that the only sure protection against charges of discrimination was to hire minority workers or admit minority students in proportion to their presence in the population. Together, the actions of Nixon and the court opened broad employment and educational opportunities for minorities and women. They also opened a Pandora's box of protests from critics who assailed the new style of affirmative action as reverse discrimination, imposed by executive order and judicial decision, not by democratically elected representatives. Yet what other remedy was there, defenders asked, to offset centuries of prejudice and opportunity denied? Among the legacies of the Nixon years was the creation in 1970 of the Environmental Protection Act, EPA, and a companion body, the Occupational Health and Safety Administration, OSHA. Their births climaxed two decades of mounting concern for the environment, beginning with the establishment in Los Angeles of the Air Pollution Control Office in 1950. Author Rachel Carson gave the environmental movement a huge boost in 1962 when she produced Silent Spring, an enormously effective piece of latter-day muckraking that exposed the poisonous effects of pesticides. Legislatively armed by the Clean Air Act of 1970, the Endangered Species Act of 1973, and similar laws, the EPA and OSHA stood on the front line of the battle for ecological sanity. They made notable progress in the ensuing decades on reducing automobile emissions and cleaning up befouled waterways and toxic waste sites. Impressed by the new environmentalist mood, Congress refused after 1972 to pay for any more of the huge irrigation projects that had watered and ecologically transformed much of the arid West over the preceding half century. Worried about creeping inflation and then running at about 5%, Nixon overcame his distaste for economic controls and imposed a 90-day wage and price freeze in 1971. To stimulate the nation's sagging exports, he's next stunned the world by taking the United States off the gold standard and devaluing the dollar. These moves effectively ended the Bretton Woods system of international currency stabilization that had functioned for more than a quarter of a century after World War II. Elected as a minority president with only 43% of the vote in 1968, Nixon devised a clever but cynical plan called the Southern Strategy to achieve a solid majority in 1972. Appointing conservative Supreme Court justices, soft-pedaling civil rights, and opposing school busing to achieve racial balance were all parts of the strategy. The Nixon landslide of 1972. But as fate would have it, the Southern Strategy became superfluous as foreign policy dominated the presidential campaign of 1972. Vietnam continued to be the burning issue. Nearly 4 years had passed since Nixon had promised as a presidential candidate to end the war and win the peace. Yet in the spring of 1972, the fighting escalated anew to alarming levels when the North Vietnamese, heavily equipped with foreign tanks, burst through the demilitarized zone, DMZ, separating the two Vietnams. Nixon reacted promptly by launching massive bombing attacks on strategic centers in North Vietnam, including Hanoi, the capital. Gambling heavily on foreign forbearance, he also ordered the dropping of contact mines to blockade the principal harbors of North Vietnam. Either Moscow or Beijing, or both, could have responded explosively, but neither did, thanks to Nixon's shrewd diplomacy. The continuing Vietnam conflict spurred the rise of South Dakota Senator George McGovern to the 1972 Democratic nomination. McGovern's promise to pull the remaining American troops out of Vietnam in 90 days earned him the backing of the large anti-war element in the party. But this appeal to racial minorities, feminists, leftists, and young alienated the traditional working-class backbone of his party. Moreover, the discovery shortly after the convention that McGovern's running mate, Missouri Senator Thomas Eagleton, had undergone psychiatric care forced Eagleton's removal from the ticket and virtually doomed McGovern's candidacy. Nixon's campaign emphasized that he had wound down the Democratic war in Vietnam from some 540,000 troops to about 30,000. His candidacy received an added boost just 12 days before the election when the high-flying Dr. Kissinger announced that peace is at hand in Vietnam and that an agreement would be settled in a few days. Nixon won the election in a landslide. His lopsided victory encompassed every state except Massachusetts and the non-state District of Columbia. He piled up 250 electoral votes to 17 for McGovern and a popular majority of 47,169,911 to 29,170,383 votes. McGovern had counted on a large number of young people's votes, but less than half the 18 to 21 age group even bothered to register to vote. The dove of peace at hand in Vietnam just before the balloting took flight. The dove of peace at hand in Vietnam just before the balloting took flight after the election. After the fighting on both sides had again escalated, Nixon launched a furious 2-week bombing of North Vietnam in an iron-handed effort to force the North Vietnamese back to the conference table. This merciless pounding drove the North Vietnamese negotiators to agree to ceasefire arrangements on January 23, 1973, nearly 3 months after peace was prematurely proclaimed. Nixon hailed the face-saving ceasefire agreements as peace with honor, but the boast rang hollow. The United States was to withdraw its remaining 27,000 or so troops and could reclaim some 560 American prisoners of war. The North Vietnamese were allowed to keep some 145,000 troops in South Vietnam, where they still occupied about 30% of the country. The shaky peace was in reality little more than a thinly disguised American retreat. The secret bombing of Cambodia and the War Powers Act. The constitutionality of Nixon's continued aerial battering of Cambodia had meanwhile been coming under increasing fire. In July 1973, America was shocked to learn that the U.S. Air Force had secretly conducted some 3,500 bombing raids against North Vietnamese positions in Cambodia beginning in March 1969 and continuing for some 14 months prior to the open American incursion in May 1970. The most disturbing feature on these sky forays was that while they were going on, American officials, including the president, had sworn that Cambodian neutrality was being respected. Countless Americans began to wonder what kind of representative government they had if the United States had been fighting a war they knew nothing about. Defiance followed secretiveness. After the Vietnam ceasefire in January 1973, Nixon brazenly continued large-scale bombing of communist forces in order to help the rightist Cambodian government, and he repeatedly vetoed congressional efforts to stop him. The years of bombing inflicted grisly wounds on Cambodia, blasting its people, shredding its economy, and revolutionizing its politics. The long-suffering Cambodian soon groaned under the sadistic heel of Pol Pot, a murderous tyrant who dispatched as many as 2 million of his people to their graves. He was forced from power, ironically enough, only by a full-dressed Vietnamese invasion in 1978, followed by a military occupation that dragged on for a decade. Congressional opposition to the expansion of presidential war-making powers by Johnson and Nixon led to the War Powers Act in November 1973. Passed over Nixon's veto, it required the president to report to Congress within 48 hours after committing troops to a foreign conflict or substantially enlarging American combat units in a foreign country. Such a limited authorization would have to end within 60 days unless Congress extended it for 30 more days. The War Powers Act was but one manifestation of what came to be called the New Isolationism, a mood of caution and restraint in the conduct of the nation's foreign affairs after the bloody and futile misadventures in Vietnam. Meanwhile, the draft ended in January 1973, although it was retained on a standby basis. Future members of the armed forces were to be volunteers, greatly easing anxieties among draft-age youth. The Arab oil embargo and the energy crisis. The long, rumbling Middle East erupted anew in October 1973, when the rearmed Syrians and Egyptians unleashed surprise attacks on Israel and attempts to regain the territory they had lost in the Six-Day War of 1967. With the Israelis in desperate retreat, Kissinger, who had become Secretary of State in September, hastily flew to Moscow in an effort to restrain the Soviets, who were arming the attackers. Believing that the Kremlin was poised to fly combat troops to the Suez area, Nixon placed America's nuclear forces on alert and ordered a gigantic airlift of nearly $2 billion in war materials to the Israelis. This assistance helped save the day, as the Israelis aggressively turned the tide and threatened Cairo itself before American diplomacy brought about an uneasy ceasefire. America's policy of backing Israel against its oil-rich neighbors exacted a heavy penalty. Late in October 1973, the Arab nations suddenly clamped an embargo on oil for the United States and for other countries supporting Israel. Americans had to suffer through a long, cold winter of lowered thermostats and speedometers. Lines of automobiles at service stations lengthened as temperatures shortened and a business recession deepened. The energy crisis suddenly energized a number of long-deferred projects. Congress approved a costly Alaska pipeline and a national speed limit of 55 miles per hour to conserve fuel. Agitation mounted for heavier use of coal and nuclear power despite the environmental threat they posed. The 5 months of the Arab blackmail embargo in 1974 clearly signaled the end of an era, the era of cheap and abundant energy. A 20-year surplus of world oil supplies had masked the fact that since 1948, the United States had been a net importer of oil. American oil production peaked in 1970 and then began an irreversible decline. Blissfully unaware of their dependence on foreign suppliers, Americans, like revelers on a binge, had more than tripled their oil consumption since the end of World War II. The number of automobiles increased 250% between 1949 and 1972, and Detroit's engineers gave nary a thought to building more fuel-efficient engines. By 1974, America was oil-addicted and extremely vulnerable to any interruption in supplies. That stark fact deeply colored the diplomatic and economic history of the 1980s, 1990s, and beyond. The Middle East loomed ever larger on the map of America's strategic interests until the United States in 1991 at last found itself pulled into a shooting war with Iraq to protect its oil supplies. The Middle Eastern sheikhs, flexing their economic muscles through OPEC, Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, approximately quadrupled their price for crude oil after lifting the embargo in 1974. Huge new oil bills wildly disrupted the U.S. balance of international trade and added further fuel to the already raging fires of inflation. The United States took the lead in forming the International Energy Agency in 1974 as a counterweight to OPEC, and various sectors of the economy, including Detroit's carmakers, began their slow, grudging adjustment to the rudely dawning age of energy dependency. But full reconciliation to that uncomfortable reality was a long time coming. Watergate and the unmaking of a president. Nixon's electoral triumph in 1972 was almost immediately sullied and eventually undone by the so-called Watergate scandal. On June 17, 1972, five men were arrested in the Watergate apartment office complex in Washington after a bungled effort to plant electronic bugs in the Democratic Party's headquarters. They were soon revealed to be working for the Republican Committee for the Re-election of the President, popularly known as CREEP. The Watergate break-in turned out to be just one in a series of Nixon administration dirty tricks that included forging documents to discredit Democrats, using the Internal Revenue Service to harass innocent citizens named on a White House enemies list, burglarizing the office of the psychiatrist who had treated the leaker of the Pentagon Papers, and perverting the FBI and CIA to cover the trickster's tracks. Meanwhile, the moral stench hanging over the White House worsened when Vice President Agnew was forced to resign in October 1973 for taking bribes from Maryland contractors while governor and also as vice president. Congress invoked the 25th Amendment to replace Agnew with a 12-term congressman from Michigan, Gerald Jerry Ford. Amid a mood of growing national outrage, a select Senate committee conducted widely televised hearings about the Watergate affair in 1973 and 74. Nixon indignantly denied any prior knowledge of the break-in and any involvement in the legal proceedings against the burglars. But John Dean III, a former White House lawyer with a remarkable memory, accused top White House officials, including the president, of obstructing justice by trying to cover up the Watergate break-in and silence its perpetrators. Then another former White House aide revealed that a secret taping system had recorded most of Nixon's Oval Office conversations. Now Dean's sensational testimony could be checked against the White House tapes, and the Senate committee could better determine who was telling the truth. But Nixon stubbornly refused to produce the taped evidence. Moreover, on October 20, 1973, he ordered the Saturday Night Massacre, firing his own special prosecutor appointed to investigate the Watergate scandal, as well as his attorney general and deputy attorney general, because they had refused to go along with firing the prosecutor. Responding to the House Judiciary Committee's demand for the Watergate tapes, Nixon agreed in the spring of 1974 to the publication of relevant portions of the tapes, with many sections missing, including Nixon's frequent obscenities, which were excised with the phrase expletive deleted. But on July 24, 1974, the president suffered a disastrous setback when the Supreme Court unanimously ruled that executive privilege gave him no right to withhold evidence relevant to possible criminal activity. Skating on thin ice over hot water, Nixon reluctantly complied. Seeking to soften the impact of inevitable disclosure, Nixon now made public three subpoenaed tapes of conversations with his chief aide on June 23, 1972. Fatally for his own case, one of them revealed the president giving orders 6 days after the Watergate break-in to use the CIA to hold back an inquiry by the FBI. Nixon's own tape-recorded words convicted him of having been an active party to the attempted cover-up. The House Judiciary Committee proceeded to draw up articles of impeachment based on obstruction of justice, abuse of the powers of the presidential office, and contempt of Congress. The public's wrath proved to be overwhelming. Republican leaders in Congress concluded that the guilty and unpredictable Nixon was a loose cannon on the deck of a ship of state. They frankly informed the president that his impeachment by the full House and removal by the Senate were foregone conclusions and he would do best to resign. Left with no better choice, Nixon choked back his tears and announced his resignation in a dramatic television appearance on August 8, 1974. Few presidents had flown so high and none had sunk so low. In his farewell address, Nixon admitted to having made some judgments that were wrong, but insisted that he had always acted in what I believed at the time to be the best interests of the nation. Unconvinced, countless Americans would change the song, Hail to the Chief, to Jail to the Chief. The nation had survived a wrenching constitutional crisis, which proved that the impeachment machinery forged by the Founding Fathers could work when public opinion overwhelmingly demanded that it be implemented. The principles that no person is above the law and that presidents must be held to strict accountability for their acts were strengthened. The United States of America, on the eve of its 200th birthday as a republic, had eventually cleaned its own sullied house, giving an impressive demonstration of self-discipline and self-government to the rest of the world. The first unelected president. Gerald Rudolph Ford, the first man to be made president solely by a vote of Congress, entered the besmirched White House in August 1974 with serious handicaps. He was widely and unfairly suspected of being little more than a dim-witted former college football player. President Johnson had sneered that Jerry was so lacking in brain power that he could not walk and chew gum at the same time. Worse, Ford had been selected, not elected, vice president, following Spiro Agnew's resignation in disgrace. The sour odor of illegitimacy hung about the president without precedent. Then, out of a clear sky, Ford granted a complete pardon to Nixon for any crimes he may have committed as president, discovered or undiscovered. Democrats were outraged, and lingering suspicions about the circumstances of the pardon cast a dark shadow over Ford's prospects of being elected president in his own right in 1976. Ford at first sought to enhance the so-called détente with the Soviet Union that Nixon had crafted. In July 1975, President Ford joined leaders from 34 other nations in Helsinki, Finland, to sign several sets of historic accords. One group of agreements officially wrote an end to World War II by finally legitimizing the Soviet-dictated boundaries of Poland and other Eastern European countries. In return, the Soviets signed a third basket of agreements guaranteeing more liberal exchanges of people and information between East and West and protecting certain basic human rights. The Helsinki Accords kindled small dissident movements in Eastern Europe and even in the USSR itself. But the Soviets soon poured ice water on these sputtering flames of freedom. Western Europeans, especially the West Germans, cheered the Helsinki Conference as a milestone of détente. But in the United States, critics increasingly charged that détente was proving to be a one-way street. American grain and technology flowed across the Atlantic to the USSR, and little of comparable importance flowed back. Moscow also continued its human rights violations, including restrictions on Jewish emigration, which prompted Congress in 1974 to add punitive restrictions to a U.S.-Soviet trade bill. Despite these difficulties, Ford at first clung stubbornly to détente. But the American public's furor over Moscow's double-dealing so steadily mounted that by the end of his term, the president was refusing to even pronounce the word détente in public. The thaw in the Cold War was threatening to prove chillingly brief. Defeat in Vietnam. Early in 1975, the North Vietnamese gave full throttle to their long-expected drive southward. President Ford urged Congress to vote still more weapons for Vietnam, but his plea was in vain, and without the crutch of the massive American aid, the South Vietnamese quickly and ingloriously collapsed. The dam burst so rapidly that the remaining Americans had to be frantically evacuated by helicopter, the last of them on April 29, 1975. Also rescued were about 140,000 South Vietnamese, most of them so dangerously identified with the Americans that they feared a bloodbath by the victorious communists. Ford compassionately admitted these people to the United States, where they added further seasoning to the melting pot. Eventually, some 500,000 arrived. America's longest, most frustrating war thus ended, not with a bang, but a whimper. In a technical sense, the Americans had not lost the war. Their client nation had. The United States had fought the North Vietnamese to a standstill and had then withdrawn its troops in 1973, leaving the South Vietnamese to fight their own war with generous shipments of costly American aircraft, tanks, and other munitions. The estimated cost to America was $118 billion in current outlays, together with some 56,000 dead and 300,000 wounded. The people of the United States had in fact provided just about everything, except the will to win, that could not be injected by outsiders. Technicalities aside, America had lost more than a war. It had lost face in the eyes of foreigners, lost its own self-esteem, lost confidence in its military prowess, and lost much of the economic muscle that had made possible its global leadership since World War II. Americans reluctantly came to realize that their power as well as their pride had been deeply wounded in Vietnam, and that recovery would be slow and painful. Feminist victories and defeats. As the Army limped home from Vietnam, there was little rejoicing on college campuses where demonstrators had once braved tear gas and billy clubs to denounce the war. The anti-war movement, like many of the other protest movements that convulsed the country in the 1960s, had long since splintered and stalled. One major exception to this pattern stood out. Although they had their differences, American feminists showed vitality and momentum. They won legislative and judicial victories and provoked an intense rethinking of gender roles. Thousands of women marched in the Women's Stride for Equality on the 50th anniversary of women's suffrage in 1970. In 1972, Congress passed Title IX of the Education Amendments, prohibiting sex discrimination in any federally assisted educational program or activity. Perhaps this act's biggest impact was to create opportunities for girls and women's athletics at schools and colleges, giving birth to a new Title IX generation that would reach maturity in the 1980s and 1990s and help professionalize women's sports as well. The Equal Rights Amendment, ERA, to the Constitution won congressional approval in 1972. It declared, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex." 28 states quickly ratified the amendment, first proposed by suffragists in 1923. Hopes rose that the ERA might soon become the law of the land. Even the Supreme Court seemed to be on the movement side. In Reed v. Reed, 1971, and Frontiero v. Richardson, 1973, the court challenged sex discrimination in legislation and employment. And in the landmark case of Roe v. Wade in 1973, the court struck down laws prohibiting abortion, arguing that a woman's decision to terminate a pregnancy was protected by constitutional right of privacy. But the feminist movement soon faced a formidable backlash. In 1972, President Nixon vetoed a proposal to set up nationwide public daycare, saying it would weaken the American family. Anti-feminists blamed the women's movement for the rising divorce rate, which tripled between 1960 and 1976. And the Catholic Church and the religious right organized a powerful grassroots movement to oppose the legalization of abortion. For many feminists, the most bitter defeat was the death of the ERA. With ratification by 38 state legislatures, the amendment would have become part of the Constitution. Conservative spokeswoman Phyllis Schlafly led the campaign to stop the ERA. Its advocates, she charged, were just bitter women seeking a constitutional cure for their personal problems. In 1979, Congress extended the deadline for ratification, but ERA opponents dug in their heels. The amendment died in 1982, three states short of success. The 70s in black and white. Although the civil rights movement had fractured, race remained an explosive issue in the 1970s. The Supreme Court in Milliken v. Bradley, 1974, blindsided school integrationists when it ruled that desegregation plans could not require students to move across school district lines. The decision effectively exempted suburban districts from shouldering any part of the burden of desegregating inner-city schools, thereby reinforcing white flight from cities to suburbs. By the same token, the decision distilled all the problems of desegregation into the least prosperous districts, often pitting the poorest, most disadvantaged elements of the white and black communities against one another. Affirmative action programs also remained highly controversial. White workers who were denied advancement and white students who refused college admission continued to raise the cry of reverse discrimination, charging that their rights had been violated by employers and admissions officers who put more weight on racial or ethnic background than on ability or achievement. One white Californian, Alan Bake, made headlines in 1978 when the Supreme Court, by the narrowest of margins, 5-4, upheld his claim that his application to medical school had been turned down because of an admissions program that favored minority applicants. In a tortured decision reflecting the troubling moral ambiguities of insoluble political complexities of this issue, the court ordered the University of California at Davis Medical School to admit Bake and declared that preference in admissions could not be given to members of any group, minority or majority, on the basis of ethnic or racial identity alone. Yet at the same time, the court said that racial factors might be taken into account in a school's overall admissions policy for purposes of assembling a diverse student body. Among the dissenters on the sharply divided bench was the court's only black justice, Thurgood Marshall. He warned in an impassioned opinion that the denial of racial preferences might sweep away years of progress by the civil rights movement. But many conservatives cheered the decision as affirming the principle that justice is colorblind. Inspired by the civil rights movement, Native Americans in the 1970s gained remarkable power through using the courts and well-planned acts of civil disobedience. But while blacks had fought against segregation, Indians used the tactics of the civil rights movement to assert their status as separate, semi-sovereign peoples. Indian activists captured the nation's attention by seizing the island of Alcatraz in 1970 and the village of Wounded Knee, South Dakota, in 1972. A series of victories in the courts consolidated the decade's gains. In the United States v. Wheeler in 1978, the Supreme Court declared that Indian tribes possessed a unique and limited sovereignty, subject to the will of Congress but not to individual states. The Bicentennial Campaign and the Carter Victory. America's 200th birthday in 1976 fell during a presidential election year, a fitting coincidence for a proud democracy. Gerald Ford energetically sought nomination for the presidency in his own right and won the Republican nod at the Kansas City Convention. The Democratic standard bearer was 51-year-old James Earl Carter, Jr., a dark horse candidate who galloped out of obscurity during the long primary election season. A peanut farmer and former Georgia governor who insisted on humble Jimmy as his first name, this born-again Baptist touched many with his down-home sincerity. He ran against the memory of Nixon and Watergate as much as he ran against Ford. His most effective campaign pitch was his promise that, "I'll never lie to you." Untainted by ties with a corrupt and cynical Washington, he attracted voters as an outsider who would clean the disorderly house of big government. Carter squeezed out a narrow victory on Election Day with 51% of the popular vote. The electoral count stood at 297 to 240. The winner swept every state except Virginia in his native South. Especially important were the votes of African Americans, 97% of whom cast their ballots for Carter. Carter enjoyed hefty Democratic majorities in both houses of Congress. Hopes ran high that the stalemate of the Nixon-Ford years between a Republican White House and a Democratic Capitol Hill would now be ended. At first, Carter enjoyed notable success as Congress granted his request to create a new cabinet-level Department of Energy and to cut taxes. The new president's popularity remained exceptionally high during his first few months in office, even when he courted public disfavor by courageously keeping his campaign promise to pardon some 10,000 draft evaders of the Vietnam War era. But Carter's honeymoon did not last long. An inexperienced outsider, he had campaigned against the Washington establishment and never quite made the transition to being an insider himself. He repeatedly rubbed congressional fur the wrong way, especially by failing to consult adequately with the leaders. Critics charged that he isolated himself in a shallow pool of fellow Georgians, whose ignorance of the ways of Washington compounded the problems of their greenhorn chief. Carter's humanitarian diplomacy. As a committed Christian, President Carter displayed from the outset an overriding concern for human rights as the guiding principle of his foreign policy. In the African nations of Rhodesia, later Zimbabwe, and South Africa, Carter and his eloquent UN ambassador Andrew Young championed the oppressed black majority. The president's most spectacular foreign policy achievement came in 1978, when he invited President Anwar Sadat of Egypt and Prime Minister Menachem Begin of Israel to a summit conference at Camp David, the woodsy presidential retreat in the Maryland Highlands. Skillfully serving as go-between, Carter persuaded the two visitors to sign an accord September 17, 1978, and that held considerable promise of peace. Israel agreed in principle to withdraw from territory conquered in the 1967 war, and Egypt in return promised to respect Israel's borders. Both parties pledged themselves to sign a formal peace treaty within 3 months. The president crowned this diplomatic success by resuming full diplomatic relations with China in early 1979, after a nearly 30-year interruption. Carter also successfully proposed two treaties, turning over complete ownership and control of the Panama Canal to the Panamanians by the year 2000. Despite these dramatic accomplishments, trouble stalked Carter's foreign policy. Overshadowing all international issues was the ominous reheating of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. Détente fell into disrepute as thousands of Cuban troops, assisted by Soviet advisors, appeared in Angola, Ethiopia, and elsewhere in Africa to support revolutionary factions. Arms control negotiations with Moscow stalled in the face of this Soviet military meddling. Economic and energy woes. Adding to Carter's mushrooming troubles was the failing health of the economy. A stinging recession during Gerald Ford's presidency brought the inflation rate down temporarily, but virtually from the moment of Carter's inauguration, prices resumed their dizzying ascent, driving the inflation rate well above 13% by 1979. The soaring bill for imported oil plunged Americans' balance of payments deeply into the red, an unprecedented $40 billion in 1978. The oil shocks of the 1970s taught Americans a painful but necessary lesson, that they could never again seriously consider a policy of economic isolation, as they had tried to do in the decades between the two world wars. For most of American history, foreign trade had accounted for no more than 10% of gross national product, GNP. But huge foreign oil bills drove that figure steadily upward in the 1970s and thereafter. By the century's end, some 27% of GNP depended on foreign trade. Unable to dominate international trade and finance as easily as they once had, Americans would have to master foreign languages and study foreign cultures if they wanted to prosper in the rapidly globalizing economy. Yawning deficits in the federal budget, reaching nearly $60 billion in 1980, further aggravated the U.S. economy's inflationary ailments. The elderly and other Americans living on fixed incomes suffered from the shrinking dollar. People with no money, with money to lend, pushed interest rates ever higher, hoping to protect themselves from being repaid in badly depreciated dollars. The prime rate, the rate of interest that banks charge their very best customers, vaulted to an unheard of 20% in early 1980. The high cost of borrowing money shoved small businesses to the wall and strangled the construction industry, heavily dependent on loans to finance new housing and other projects. Carter diagnosed America's economic disease as stemming primarily from the nation's costly dependence on foreign oil. Unfortunately, His legislative proposals in 1977 for energy conservation ignited a blaze of indifference among the American people who had already forgotten the long gasoline lines of 1973. Even events in Iran jolted Americans out of their complacency about energy supplies in 1979. The imperious Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, installed as Shah of Iran with help from America's CIA in 1953, had long ruled his oil-rich land with a will of steel. His repressive regime was finally overthrown in January 1979. Violent revolution was spearheaded in Iran by Muslim fundamentalists who fiercely resented the Shah's campaign to westernize and secularize his country. Denouncing the United States as the great Satan that had bedded the Shah's efforts, these extremists engulfed Iran in chaos in the wake of his departure. The crippling upheaval soon spread to Iran's oil fields. As Iranian oil stopped flowing into the stream of world commerce, shortages appeared, and OPEC again seized the opportunity to hike petroleum prices. Americans once more found themselves waiting impatiently in long lines at gas stations or buying gasoline only on specified days. As the oil crisis deepened, President Carter sensed the rising temperature of popular discontent. In July 1979, he retreated to the presidential mountain hideaway at Camp David, where he remained largely out of public view for 10 days. Like a royal potentate of old, summoning the wise men of the realm for their counsel in a time of crisis, Carter called in over 100 leaders from all walks of life to give him their views. Meanwhile, the nation waited anxiously for the results of these extraordinary deliberations. When Carter came down from the mountaintop on July 15, 1979, he stunned a perplexed nation by chiding his fellow citizens for falling into a moral and spiritual crisis and for being too concerned with material goods. A few days later, in a bureaucratic massacre of almost unprecedented proportions, he fired four cabinet secretaries and circled the wagons of his Georgia advisors more tightly about the White House by reorganizing and expanding the power of his personal staff. Critics began to wonder aloud whether Carter, the professed man of the people, was losing touch with the popular mood of the country. Foreign affairs and the Iranian imbroglio. Hopes for a less dangerous world rose slightly in June 1979 when Carter met with Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev in Vienna to sign the long-stalled SALT II agreements, limiting the levels of lethal strategic weapons in the Soviet and American arsenals. But conservative critics of the president's defense policies, still regarding the Soviet Union as the Wicked Witch of the East, unsheathed their long knives to carve up the SALT II treaty when it came to the Senate for debate in the summer of 1979. Political earthquakes in the petroleum-rich Persian Gulf region finally buried all hopes of ratifying the SALT II treaty. On November 4, 1979, a howling mob of rabidly anti-American Muslim militants stormed the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, Iran, and took all of its occupants hostage. The captors then demanded that the American authorities ship back to Iran the exiled Shah, who had arrived in the United States 2 weeks earlier for medical treatment. World opinion hotly condemned the diplomatic felony in Iran, while Americans agonized over both the fate of the hostages and the stability of the entire Persian Gulf region, so dangerously close to the Soviet Union. The Soviet Army then aroused the West's worst fears on December 27, 1979, when it blitzed into the mountainous nation of Afghanistan, next door to Iran, and appeared to be poised for a thrust at the oil jugular of the Gulf. President Carter reacted vigorously to these alarming events. He slapped an embargo on the export of grain and high-technology machinery to the USSR and called for a boycott of the upcoming Olympic Games in Moscow. He proposed the creation of a rapid deployment force to respond to suddenly developing crises in faraway places and requested that young people, including women, be made to register for a possible military draft. The president proclaimed that the United States would use any means necessary, including force, to protect the Persian Gulf against Soviet incursions. He grimly conceded that he had misjudged the Soviets, and the SALT II treaty became a dead letter in the Senate. Meanwhile, the Soviet army met unexpectedly stiff resistance in Afghanistan and bogged down in a nasty decade-long guerrilla war that came to be called Russia's Vietnam. The Iranian hostage episode was Carter's and America's bed of nails. The captured Americans languished in cruel captivity, while the nightly television news broadcast in the United States showed humiliating scenes of Iranian mobs burning the American flag and spitting on effigies of Uncle Sam. Carter at first tried to apply economic sanctions and the pressure of world public opinion against the Iranians, while waiting for the emergence of a stable government with which to negotiate. But the political turmoil in Iran rumbled on endlessly, and the president's frustration grew. Carter at last ordered a daring rescue mission. A highly trained commando team penetrated deep into Iran's sandy interior. Their plan required tick-tock perfect timing to succeed, and when equipment failures prevented some members of the team from reaching their destination, the mission had to be scrapped. As the commandos withdrew in the dark desert night, two of their aircraft collided, killing eight of the would-be rescuers. This disastrous failure of the rescue raid proved anguishing for Americans. The episode seemed to underscore the nation's helplessness and even incompetence in the face of a mortifying insult to the national honor. The stalemate with Iran dragged on throughout the rest of Carter's term, providing an embarrassing backdrop to the embattled president's struggle for re-election.